Welcome to the Going to Seed podcast. This episode, we're talking to Taylor, a US amateur crop breeder who is working on so many different species and genera that I have trouble keeping up with them all. So to get us started, Taylor, can you tell us a bit about your background and the path that led you to crop breeding?
Yeah, I guess if I'm starting early in undergrad, I took some classes, ethnobotany classes, and became sort of interested in and useful plants. And after that, a couple years after that, I took a permaculture course. And then that's when I started gardening and just playing around, doing different crop trials and becoming interested in, well, I wasn't interested really in breeding at that point, but I came later interested in breeding after coming upon the Carol Depp's book, Breed Your Own Vegetable Varieties. And around that same time, I also read an older book by a Russian plant breeder named Ivan Maturin. And then after I read those two books, I became really, really interested in especially wide crossing.
There's a huge amount of potential there that I'm really excited to talk about the stuff that you're working on. So could you tell us a bit about your local growing conditions, like what resources in terms of space and soil and climate and just everything that you're using as a resource for plant breeding to give us an idea of how you do it?
Yeah, I live in Southwest Virginia. It's a USDA zone 7B. It's a humid climate, frosty in the winter, but not extremely so. The space that I'm working on right now is fairly small, but I'm also growing on a couple of my friends' plots as well for some of the things that take up a little bit more space, cucumber family things. What else?
What soil type are you working with?
Oh yeah, it's very heavy clay around here, which yeah, once you get going, once you get a couple of good season on it, starts to get pretty nice and flush though, so can't complain.
Do you also work with a greenhouse and plants in pots as well?
Yes, I do. I do work with potted plants, particularly when I'm trying to make a cross with something that's less hardy, you know, a tropical cousin to a more cold hardy species. So I do, but not, I haven't, I've only been, this is only my second growing season at the house that we live in now. So that's, you know, kind of hit the reset button on a lot of things since I became interested in plant breeding, you know, moving several times, just trying to keep certain collections going.
Do you find that's one of the underappreciated benefits of breeding things and having seeds that you can just pack it all up in a box and even wait a few years if life gets in the way?
Yes, most definitely. And I would say a lot of the species that I am interested in, have been interested in, are herbaceous perennials, to where you get the advantage of, you know, quick seed to seed growing, as well as the vegetative propagation, and that's also a nice, yeah.
Just on some more mundane practical issues, when you're growing out in the ground, how do you deal with fertility and weeds and pests and irrigation for that matter?
It's a continual learning process, I guess. I mean, as far as the distribution of rain goes, we're pretty blessed around here. You know, droughts are things that exist on the scale of like weeks or months, mm-hmm. You know, so they're not. And because my growing now and up until now has always been more on the small scale with hand tools, I approach problems at kind of a small scale level. As far as weeds go, you know, I'm out in the garden. It's not a huge space, so I may pull them or mulch them or plant ground covers. And then a lot of the stuff that I grow is pretty just vigorous and tough anyway, so it can hopefully compete okay.
And do you have any pest problems, or do you try and breed for pest resistance?
Yeah, here in the eastern U.S., it seems like more and more every year there's a new, I think, spotted lanternfly just showed up in the county adjacent to us, and we just got allium leaf miner. It takes out a lot of the onion crops. So A lot of them I'm still learning with how to deal with, but whenever I can, I try to see if there's room for selection for more resistance, for sure.
So, moving on, what are your broad priorities in crop breeding? Like what traits and qualities and end uses are you particularly interested in?
Yeah, if I could put it all under one rubric, maybe it's too much, but to have things that are generally resilient. So, and I may define that pretty broadly from just like a vigorous plant in and of itself, but also, resilient in terms of will my family eat it? Is it like we were saying with pet, is it more pest resistant, more disease resistant? Is it easier to process in the kitchen? Does it have a longer storage time? Can it self-seed? In these types of qualities.
Yeah, no, I can definitely relate to that. So now we get into the nitty-gritty. I'm really excited about this because you've got so many interesting breeding projects. So which particular species do you want to start telling us about? Maybe the Chinese yams, I think, was one that I really wanted to talk about.
The Chinese yams are a fascinating species and crop, and partly due to the fact that I started out on a small scale. Like I said, I'm still growing relatively small scale. In terms of starches and carbohydrates, I became more focused in on the root crops for that reason instead of the grains. And it became apparent that the Chinese yam, coming from an analogous climate to where I am on the eastern US, China and Japan, where they're cultivated on a large scale, it became salient as a crop that would grow really well here and is a good, kind of potato substitute starch crop. And so I think that one became on my radar early on when I was looking at that. But yams are one of the hardest crops to start breeding with. There's chromosome differences. It's hard to find a lot of genetic diversity. There's different separate male and female plants. There's problems you get with similar to a lot of other clonal root and tuber crops where there's degrees of sterility. And so I wouldn't say it's a crop that I've made a lot of progress on necessarily, other than in the early stages now of starting to do some seed growing. And for years it was just, well, how can I find a female plant?
How did you get it go about collecting diversity of that particular crop?
Two main sources. There's, well, first of all, the kinds of cultivars of Chinese yam which are available 99% of the time. I wasn't too interested in growing as a root crop because they're called snake yams, and they grow vertical straight down, and you have to excavate them, and you don't even see the tuber until you've excavated 20 inches down. You don't even start to see the beginning of it. And so two main sources that I got the sort of what I consider the better genetics that are, they may divide like potatoes, but essentially they're more horizontal as opposed to vertical. So there, you can just pop them out of the ground like you would Dioscorea alata or something. And those I sourced from Mountain Gardens from the late Joe Hollis. I got a few cultivars from him. He was one of the most enthusiastic supporters of Chinese yams in the US. Incredible gardener and person. And then another few cultivars I got years ago online from Japan, back when it was sort of easier to do that thing where they were just being exported as a food, as a potato.
So, do you do any controlled pollination? Because I've tried to do this with my limited yam diversity, and those little tiny primitive flowers look like a nightmare to work with.
No, up to now I'm lucky. It just looks like the native. I'm not really sure if they're thrips or some other type of small insect. Seems to pollinate them fairly well, even when they're not, directly adjacent one cultivar to the other. So, but no, I'm like you. I've played around looking at the collecting pollen but the small flowers have dissuaded me, but luckily the open pollination has been working.
It was on my to-do list for crossing them, and then yeah, the species I had on hand were so distant I would have had to do deliberate crossing, and I'm like, let's maybe put that off for a few years.
Yeah, I haven't. I've been working with the same species, so
Have you been tempted to bring in any other species to add to the collection just to see if you get spontaneous crossing? Because hybridization seems to be fairly common in the genus.
Yeah. The only other species which I'm currently growing is Dioscorea bulbifera, the air potato, which is, you know, coming from a more warmer climate than we have here. It's not winter hardy in the grounds. I take the tubers inside, and then sometimes, like last year where it was a El Nino, very the coolest summer ever, like the what we call the air potato, the Dioscorea bulbifera, didn't really even sprout until like August. So that's the only other species I have currently. If I can get the timing right, I will certainly attempt to see if the insects would like to cross them.
Here's the thing people should understand. Often when you're doing these wide crosses, it will take years for just the right season to like line all of the stars up for you. And I mean, you can often overcome those barriers with a lot of deliberate effort, but sometimes just growing things side by side and waiting and keeping your eyes open, you can get lucky that way too. And I've got a bit of an obsession with aerial tubers. There's only a few plants that do this. And I think it has so much potential to be a trait that's developed into crops so that you can have a tuber crop that you don't actually need to do all of that digging to harvest.
Yeah, that would be fabulous to be able to cross those two species. I think it would make our current species, the Chinese yam, it would make it kind of less weedy, because it would make the aerial tubers, if they're bigger, they're not going to sort of roll away from you.
Yeah.
As easily. But the Chinese yam is, you know, it's cultivated for its aerial tubers, as it is. You know, they're just small.
They're just very small.
They're small. Yeah, they're kind of the size of maybe like a lima bean or something like that. Yeah, and you have to set out a tarp and shake the vine on there, and you get tons of these little. Well, depending on the cultivar, some produce a lot, some produce hardly any. So that's definitely an avenue of selection.
Interesting. Oh, you've got me even more excited about that crop now. So let's move on to another crop, because I know you've got quite a few. Which one do you want to talk about next?
I would say the crop that I have the most experience breeding with now is Passiflora. We have a native species, Passiflora incarnata, which has the ability to cross with apparently quite a number of other species. So that's where I kind of dipped my toes in the water with wanting to, okay, here's a great resilient species that we have that already has this ability to be somewhat compatible with all these other. It's actually a sister species of tropical passion fruits and tastes a little bit different. So that was just something I was curious about from the beginning. Here's a good opportunity to get a species that's already grown. There's already people that have been selecting hybrids and making polyploids, and so I could kind of just play with that, with a lot of the work that has been done already.
Have you taken that project in any particular unique direction for your local conditions?
Yeah, I've got several selections now that have the, you know, at least the majority of the cold hardiness, which is our native species. It dies back to the roots and then, you know, runs from the roots, so you can propagate it through root division very easily. So yeah, I've gotten a few selections which have more of, I guess, what I would consider like domesticated qualities, coming from the, you know, the typical passion fruits that people would see in the store, you know, but more of a orange colored arils that are juicy and that seem to be a little bit more enjoyable. Not that the native species doesn't taste good on its own. There's a certain selections of it which already taste, you know, really nice.
It's interesting. We've got the Passiflora fotida has done really well here in the last few years, and the goats eat around it in the paddock. So it's just everywhere at the moment. I'm picking handfuls of them, and I've been tempted to do some breeding work with it, but it's fairly low on my priority list. But are you doing hand pollination with the Passiflora, because they're nice big chunky flowers?
Yeah, Exactly. Yeah. And I've got about maybe 40 something seedlings that I sprouted last year that overwintered in the ground that will fruit this year that I'll get to evaluate and do some harsh selection on and really just find the ones that have the most, fertility, the most full fruits. And the rest will be attempted to be weeded out for for probably a few years
Are they a little
with
bit,
how they grow.
are they a little bit of a pain to get rid of when you don't want them?
Yes.
It
Yeah, but it's ideally with
swings and
something like
roundabouts.
that.
You can't have it both ways.
Right. Exactly. Yeah, if you want the vigor and the resilience, sometimes it's, but I will say in that regard, one thing that came up from crossing with the tropical passion fruit species is less expansiveness by roots. Some of the selections kind of stay put and are more, that was, so that actually that to answer your last question, that's a big plus in terms of, yeah, kind of backyard cultivation in this climate, is to have something that doesn't run 20 feet in a season
But still gives you
and
enough of a
still
runner that
stays.
if you wanted to dig it up and move it
Ig
somewhere else, it'd be easy.
yep yep clumps versus runs. Yeah, so I found a couple of those and just gotta get the right balance with getting some more fruitfulness and already finding like really wonderful flavors. And but like I said, for me it was just a good experience to learn, play around with some wide crosses.
Now, could you tell us a bit about the work you're doing with goji berries? I'm so jealous because I absolutely refuse to grow here in my humid, hot climate.
Well, the goji berry, the traditional, well, the climate that gojis come from is high desert. So really, most of the cultivars that the berries that you find in the store and the berry cultivars are really more suited to places like that, or like where, Joseph Lofthouse lives. So the humidity in this climate throughout the growing season presents some fungal issues, powdery mildew and some other fungi on the leaves of goji. But I became more excited about goji after I started growing a hybrid, an interspecific hybrid called Stardust that has really nice fresh eating berries, which is sort of unusual. Gojis are, if you pick them fresh, they're a bittersweet flavor. They taste a little bit more moderated once you dry them. But so I'm growing some selections now from that parent that have a blueberry grape flavor, and they're also, the berries are juicy. So I'm growing some selections with that crossed with another species of goji, which is a leaf cultivar, but has really good fungal resistance. So I'm excited about those, because then I can make a, have the because also because goji is a leaf vegetable, which is why one reason I'm also excited about it, because you have these bushes that can grow very quickly from seed and produce a lot of delicious shoots, especially some of these selections from this hybrid. So it's a great multi-use plant in China. They eat the shoots, the leaves, the berries. The berries yield over a long time, several months. You can even use the root bark for fevers and different types of inflammation, and it just isn't messed with by a lot of animals. Deer will nibble on it here and there. So it's definitely got some good qualities. They're lanky bushes. You have to prune them, or if you don't, that's fine too. But they have little spurs on them, like little thorny things, which dissuade some people. But I think with the right cultivar, considering everything, there some nice selection can be made, particularly with these new cultivars I'm growing that are really nice for fresh eating. So they're also not particularly expansive in my climate by the roots. Like I know in some climates they'll run, like the passiflora that we were just talking, they'll run, whatever, 15, 20 feet underground and pop up. For whatever reason, they don't really seem to do that here. So
It could
yeah,
be your
I ate a lot
your
of
heavy
goji.
clay. It might be your heavy clay that slows it down.
Yeah, I think it's probably that, and maybe also, well, I guess I'll find out once I grow more selections for sure. But
And with the goji berries, were you doing controlled hand pollination with them if you were making deliberate crosses? Because they're quite small bumblebee pollinated flowers, I believe.
No, I just did open pollination. I was waiting for my leaf goji, Lycium chinense cultivar, to flower last year, and then as soon as it synced up with this hybrid, it was the seeds formed right away.
So if you normally just grow a single clone, do you get like seedless fruit, or how do you distinguish from self-pollination?
Yeah, that's a good point. Well, they do. Most goji cultivars that you grow, you only need a single clone. They will self, but because the one I was growing am growing the Stardust goji, it appears to be male sterile. I assume from being an interspecies hybrid, so it solved the problem of selfing for me.
It's brilliant. It's not, it's always nice if you can avoid that fiddle work and squinting at little tiny flowers.
I don't mind doing it, but if it can be avoided, that's great too.
Now, were there any other projects that you wanted to talk about?
I'm gonna try for some different F1s this year. Oh yeah, I'll t I guess I guess the other one I'd like to talk about maybe is a cucurbita, a pumpkin cross that I made last year with a wild Mexican pumpkin
Oh,
called
wow.
Cucurbita lundelliana. That I made. I got a few fruits at the end of the year. I had one seedling pop up from this seed packet, and I was really rooting for it to grow, and it did. And so I got a few fruits with pollinated by Cucurbita ficifolia, the shark fin melon was a pollen donor. So I'm actually this week about to send these seeds to a few different growers, because I got more of the F1 seed than I'll need. But that project was a little bit of a curiosity,
So,
working with a wild species that's bitter and that sort of thing. But it became very attractive to me because the wild species is an ancestor to all five domesticated pumpkin and squash species. So it retains the ability to cross fairly easily with. So the shark fin melon, the ficifolia species, up to now hasn't been successfully, well, they've made F1s, but it hasn't really gone past the F1s with the other domesticated species. So I thought, well, that last year was my first year growing that species as well. And I was really just impressed how it grew huge and grew up trees, and then found out that it stores really well, even stores really well if you pick it immature as a summer squash. So I have some that I harvested in October as little small, like summer squash size, that are still in fantastic condition, just sitting in my dining room in a bowl,
So,
and they can just be cooked up. Yeah.
so does the bitterness go from the flesh? Is this the shark fin melon we're talking about, or the wild
Oh,
Lundelliana
sorry.
that's
Yeah, no,
bitter?
I'm talking about the shark fin.
Okay.
The Lundelliana, the wild Mexican ancestral pumpkin species, is very, very bitter, but it's eaten by the Maya. They grind it up into a flour, and I think they maybe do some leaching or something, and their palates are probably more used to a little bit bitter, like a bitter melon
Is it
or
more of a
something.
seed
So
crop? It's maybe more of a seed crop.
they grind the whole thing up into a meal.
Ah, interesting.
But
Interesting.
it is sold in markets in Mexico as an edible species. But it is bitter, very, very bitter. So for my purposes, yeah, just being able to cross it with a different domesticated pumpkin species. So the F1 seeds will be all bitter, and then I'll have to do a back cross to domestic species to kind of select that out.
So I'm guessing that the idea is when you make a relatively wide hybrid like this, the F1 population often has weaker fertility barriers to other species. Like it gets a bit confused about its identity. So the hope is that those F1 hybrids of the Ficifolia and the Lundelliana should be relatively easy to cross with Maximas and Mosjardas and anything else, Pipos.
You can cross it. So the work done on crossing with the Lundelliana was done in the 50s, and so I just found the papers when I was looking into pumpkin wide crossing, and I just found a few papers about it, And it, it just, because it's ancestral to the domestic spayed species, it, like, forming the F1s was not a problem at all. Like, for every pollination I made took, you know, and every fruit had a good number of seeds in it. You know, germination, I haven't done any tests yet. I'll start a couple of those soon, but all the seeds look good. Open a few of them up, and there's embryos. So I already knew from looking at those papers that I wasn't gonna, it wasn't gonna be a dead end at the F1. In fact, the F1s with the Ficifolia, you know, have like 50% male pollen fertility. The same thing with and Maxima. Even the male fertility, the pollen fertility on the F1s is decent. You just have to cross them back to a domesticated mother. It's important to get the, it's important to recover the domestic cytoplasm, the seed parent, the seed parent aspect. So yeah, so I already knew that it wasn't going to be too much trouble as far as like what you're saying, a lot of wide crosses, you can get stuck, or it can be very, very tricky to kind of go past the F1.
Fascinating. I'm really excited about that. I'll have to follow up with you and see how that goes with the next generations.
Based on the papers that I read, the hybrid vigor of these crosses is, even when you go back, when you do a back cross of the domestic and you got a three-quarter domestic pumpkin, they put out more than 40 fruits per plant. So this would be a lot of great kind of ancestral genetics to give. You know, in my case, vine borer resistance is a big one, and also heat, the heat tolerance of the Mexican pumpkin, the Lundeliana, is very, very good. Whereas the shark fin melon is, you know, kind of wants to be in the park shade and starts to suffer once it gets above, you know, 90 degrees.
Now, as an aside, you seem to have a really great talent for finding papers on particular topics. So, could you tell us how you do that research? Like, what resources do you use? I'm guessing mostly online.
Mostly a combination of Google Scholar as well as Sci-Hub. So yeah, in my case, I don't have a background, like formal background in like biology or something, but I was so interested in the possibilities of crossing and wide crossing that I just started reading the papers over and over till I understood them. But yeah, using those two, the Google Scholar and the Sci-Hub, is can you can find a lot on there to see if, you know, if
It's an incredibly powerful combination that anyone with a library card who can get internet access can tap into. Would it be millions of papers that you can sift through in an afternoon to
Yeah,
find the
it seems
gold?
like it. Yeah. And a lot of these, the work is already, you know, especially if you're working for a species that has a domestic, you know, member in the genus, you know, you're probably going to find that work, whether it was successful or not, or to what degree.
I would maybe just take a moment to point out to people too, if you don't have a scientific background and you pull up a research paper, people often think that you're supposed to be able to read it from the beginning to end, like a novel, and understand every part of it. And that's not how scientists write or read papers. You basically just pick out a few little details that are relevant to what you're working with, and the rest of it is just kind of like for someone else. So yeah, learning to read papers selectively and not stressing if you run into something, you're like, what the hell is this word? If you don't know it,
Exactly.
it may not be relevant to what you're doing at all.
Start at the abstract, see if, yeah, if you can find anything about the fertility of the crosses. There's all sorts of barriers, there's all sorts of ways that obstacles, so you can kind of see, is it, did it happen at the flower, or did they able to get the seed and it happened in the F1, or and so on.
Now, the thing I really wanted to talk to you about, not that all of this hasn't been absolutely fascinating. So you're somebody who's been going down the path of mentor grafting. And I think this is a technique that more people should know about and start tinkering with. So do you want to just give us an overview about what mentor grafting is?
Sure, yeah. Mentor grafting is a way of creating what are called graft hybrids or vegetative hybrids. They've gotten those two names traditionally. And it's essentially a way of bypassing the barriers that come from, you know, pollinization and normal see growing sexual reproduction to get some characteristics from the rootstock into the scion, and or the seed of the scion in the subsequent generations. That's the objective of mentor grafting, is to create graft hybrids, which have been kind of a controversial subject in the Western world for a number of decades, but you know, more and more evidence is coming to light. So I guess I could talk about the specific technique of it. Basically, you graft a young seedling in the, or very early on in its development, when it has cotyledons, if you can, still. And you graft it onto a rootstock that's of an older age, you know, with more biomass. And as the seedling grows, as the scion takes and then grows, you do a pruning process where you only leave 1 to 2 leaves at the apex of the scion. So you're forcing a kind of one-way sap flow of all the different biomolecules from this kind of older, bushier rootstock. You're shunting them all into this young seedling. And ideally, that seedling is a hybrid.
Mm. Yeah, again, just make it a bit unsure about what it is and kind of stir up its genetics to make it more receptive.
Exactly. So yeah, I think it's a very promising technique, and it's not one that, you know, sort of amateur breeders and hobbyists have really explored very much. So I think like you said, there's a lot of potential for, yeah.
It's worth pointing out too that this graft hybridization has been observed for like thousands of years. It goes back to the early days of grafting, particularly fruit trees, mm-hmm. for the first species that it was done with. But there's been a lot of work on it in Asia that has demonstrated very clear traits being transferred from the rootstock to the scion, which mm-hmm. then persist through seed generations produced from the scion. So there's some kind of genetic element that's been permanently transferred. And I think you sent me some papers that more recently they've developed genetic evidence that things like chloroplasts and mitochondria and jumping genes are actually moving mm-hmm. between the two in a permanent way.
Yeah. In general, it can be a very, I guess, complex process. It looks like, you know, some of the papers, when you look at them, they're showing a differential gene expression of a couple thousand different genes. So mm-hmm. that's actually also a promising thing, to be able to potentially work on more like polygenic or quantitative types of traits, which mm-hmm. are often the ones that are more interesting to people wanting to develop food crops. And I should say that it's different from a graft chimera, where you have the adjacent layers.
Yeah, that's when you get a mosaic of cells from the rootstock and the scion kind of woven together mm-hmm. in a bud to create a kind of half and half
exactly.
plant. Yeah, and they tend not to be stable in the long run, that you'll get shoots of one or the other plant re-emerging in time.
Mm-hmm. Sorry, but what were you going to say?
Oh, I was just going to point out that this phenomenon of graft hybridization, of mentor grafting, there's evidence for it happening naturally, both through parasitic plants and possibly through plant roots touching each other underground and melding together between different species. Right. So particularly if you look at mistletoes and parasitic plants like that, they graft themselves, they have genes that they've taken up from their hosts that shouldn't be there according to simple branching phylogenetic trees. So the idea that this is unnatural, it's like, no, nature does it all the time. And we're kind of coming along late to the party saying, could we join in too? Could we have fun too?
Yeah. I think that's an important point. I was going to say something else regarding that point. It escaped my mind though.
Oh, and there was one other thing. So microbes live inside and on the surfaces of plants in like a symbiotic relationship. And a lot of these were only recently discovered. Like there's fungal hyphae inside plant tissues that are so long and thin that you don't see them when you do a microscopic section unless you know what you're looking for. And I have a strong suspicion that there are microbial symbionts moving between the two species as well. And that's something that hasn't been properly investigated yet.
Yeah, yes. And another thing that I'd like to say about it is that the technique itself, the intergrafting technique, was developed by a Russian plant breeder named Ivan Maturin. And what he was trying to offer to plant breeders, it was a way of making new selections, a way of plant breeding where you could be successful with relatively small population sizes using graft hybridization. So in his life, he was mostly poor and working on with relatively meager resources, small land, small population sizes of fruit trees. He was very into palmology. And so he, through developing this technique, he really made sure to emphasize that you could make progress this way, even with a small population size of fruit trees, you know, 30 to 40 individuals. And because of the influence of the graft, and the amount of time that the graft lives being mentor grafted, it's a change by degree, sort of a quantitative change by degree that you can influence a plant. So when you're growing these young hybrids, feet from seed, you can get a greater amount of sort of, even though it's a very chaotic process, sort of predictability of depending on the other species that is serving as the rootstock and the amount of time that you leave it on there. So that's actually what really inspired me to start learning about like taxonomy and different species relationships.
Even more interesting, you sent me papers of Chinese researchers doing extremely wide mentor graft hybridization. So I think there was a mung bean grafted onto a sweet potato that then caused like a cascade of heritable traits in the mung bean. And I think I even saw one between a monocot and a dicot.
A wheat on sweet potato. There's a whole bunch of research that have done in China on wide mentor grafting of vegetable crops. And what it looks like is that there's a lot of mutation that goes on through that type of process, as you might imagine. But it is a mentor grafting research where they're pruning the scion so that it's pulling more from the rootstock, and then they collect the seeds. But the type of variation that comes from all of that research, strongly based on the transposable elements and chromosome rearrangement. So it's very kind of like mutagenic rather than like
radiation and chemicals.
But I mean to say, rather than like having the mung bean like end up with a sweet potato leaf, in that case it's so.
Oh, yeah. It's basically a way of stimulating the mung bean to mix itself up in all sorts of unpredictable ways. You're not necessarily going to turn
say,
you're not going to turn a mung bean into a sweet potato.
Right. But on the other hand, you know, they've done research where they grafted grapes onto Schizandra vines. And in that case, you know, after year, first of all, they were graft compatible, which is wild, but through several years, the grape gradually take on more of the characteristics of the Schizandra vines. So when you look at the research on this type of stuff, you see a lot of things, different types of mechanisms. There's a lot of, there's a lot of different mechanisms at play. I don't think they're contradictory as much as just all part of a big,
And I would point out this kind of mentor grafting work is probably more suitable for people with very small growing spaces where they've got a lot of time to do the fiddly grafting and get the techniques right.
Yeah.
Whereas someone who's got acres, they just spend all of their time producing and they don't have necessarily time left over to fiddle.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that's very true, because even more than regular grafting, I mean, a lot of more and more vegetable growers, it seems like, are doing grafting now. I was reading a guy the other day who was talking about his cucumbers that were grafted on, I think it may have been shark fin melon rootstock, and he got 5 times the yield over the growing season of the cucumber. So he was saying, you know, it's more effort doing the graft. But yeah, a mentor graft would be even more intensive because you're not really, you're not harvesting from the plant and you're having to go and, you know, prune it continually. But once you get the variation, and you also get hybrid vigor from this in the seedlings, which is nice too. But yeah, once you get the variation, you can either keep going and you can do repeat grafting of the off-type seeds that you're selecting, the variant seeds. You can graft them backed on, and then you start, you know, increasing the amount of variation that you see if you're doing it from seed year after year. So it'll go from like 2% to 5% to 7% to whatever, you know, 15% year after year if you just constantly select the off types and repeat the process.
Well, this
So
is
yeah,
why
but
I'm,
it's very fiddly. It's very fiddly, yes, for sure. But it, you know, once you get that variation, then you don't need to continue grafting. So maybe you can get your, you know, cucumbers that give you whatever 4 times the yield. Maybe you can get them without having to keep grafting them potentially.
So yeah, I would strongly encourage listeners out there who are in the amateur plant breeding community to look into the possibilities of what mental grafting can do for you, because I think it's something that it's like it's a lottery ticket, basically. Whenever you bring two plants together, you never quite know what is going to happen, but that just makes it more exciting, in my book at least.
Yeah, and it's very different from a typical kind of graft, you know, like I said, where you want to leave a lot of biomass, a lot of bushiness on the rootstock because you need it to photosynthesize and produce all those biomolecules that can then be shunted into the scion. So it's different in that regard. It's also different because you're pruning the scion as it grow the leaves of the scion as it grows. And yeah, if you can use a hybrid scion, whether it's got lots of genetic diversity from a land race or just two different accessions of a species, or whether it's a wider hybrid. And then so you start to see all this as kind of like on a spectrum, where if you're using seed that's an interspecies hybrid, you're going to see more success of the graft hybrids, more variation occur. And then likewise, if you're using a root stock that's even more distant, like let's say you're you know, grafting a tomato onto a lychee tomato, you're going to see more variation in your tomato seeds, mentor grafting it onto a lychee tomato, than you are onto just another tomato.
There's just
And so
so many
you can kind of see
possibilities.
the different,
There's
yeah.
so many possibilities, but yeah, people just have to get out there and start playing around with it. So I hope this has inspired at least some of you out there to give it a go. Okay, bonus round questions. If you could work wonders and wave a magic wand over any species, what would you create?
Maybe a cold hardy breadfruit would
Oh, yes.
be nice.
I mean, there's more AC that go into pretty cold regions, so the family can do it. So
Right.
And well, you'd probably want to start with bread nut because it's the one that produces fertile seeds. But yeah, I would agree. Huge amount of potential there.
I'll have to wait for I get a greenhouse for that one. I got a few different mulberry species at the moment in pots, so yeah. one day.
So what is your vision for the future of food in your community?
I would like to see a lot more, I guess, small holders, you know, backyard growers, instead of all this lawn and these ornamental bushes, which are fine. But I would like to see a lot more growing and breeding happen in smaller spaces, at least to start off with, to create a kind of, you know, more of a mosaic, more of a patchwork of diversity.
I mean, there's just, you look at how undisturbed natural communities have different species and all these little different niches. And it just makes you realize like every little patch of land has its own potential. And in a human managed environment, we could have a corresponding diversity of crops. we could have more diversity than natural systems can achieve through our interventions in theory. So yeah, it's exciting.
Exactly.
So how do you hope to pass your work on to other breeders and future generations?
Well, I do trade and I share seeds with people. So I guess primarily that way. And my daughter, I'm currently teaching, is four, garden. Her first ever tomato that she ever ate was an interspecies hybrid, one of Joseph's promiscuous tomatoes, actually.
I love that. I love that so much. She's going to eat like a store-bought tomato one day and just be like, what the hell is this? Tomato's not supposed to taste that bad. Okay, and what's your final message to people who are thinking of getting into crop breeding?
Just find something that you know, a crop that you like or that you think is interesting, or maybe there's a problem that you want to solve with something that you, a crop that you already grow. And yeah, just start playing around. You don't need I don't have a background in genetics or anything like that. So just start with what you enjoy and experiment.
Don't be afraid to stuff up and kill things.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
It's all part of it. And final end plug opportunity, if people want to get in touch with you, what's the best way to do so?
You can message me on the Going to Seed forum. I don't currently have a blog or anything like that yet, but
it's a wonderful community. So yeah, I would encourage anyone who's thinking of getting into plant breeding to check it out and say hi and see all of the other amazing work that so many people are doing.
Yes.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Taylor, for taking the time to talk to us today. This has been a fascinating episode, and hopefully we can get you back in another season or two to see how your projects have developed.
My pleasure, Shane. Sounds like a plan.
Brilliant. Thank you.
Take care.